My dad works in B2B marketing. He came by my school for career day and said he was a big ROAS man. Then he told everyone how much he loved calculating his return on ad spend. My friends still laugh at me to this day.
Not everyone gets B2B, but with LinkedIn, you'll be able to reach people who do. Get a $100 credit on your next ad campaign. Go to linkedin.com/results to claim your credit. That's linkedin.com/results. Terms and conditions apply. LinkedIn, the place to be, to be.
In life, some days are good, and some could be better. The same is true for recovery. Both take work. Both take adjustments. Finding your path is a key part of your journey, and then it's all about walking it every day. Embrace the good days, the not so good days, and the challenges, and acknowledge how you overcame them. Be open to every part of the journey and welcome it. It's unique, and it's all part of you. Find the path to recovery that works for you. Learn more at cdc.gov/stopoverdose.
If you want the real story behind the NFL, you need the Stinkin' Truth Podcast. Three-time Super Bowl champ Mark Schlereth breaks down the biggest plays, the biggest games, and the untold stories that make this game what it is. Follow the Stinkin' Truth in the Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts.
So the last I saw you in person, long before COVID ever existed, you were performing in Houston. You did the Great Depression before the Great Depression aired. So I felt special because I felt, well, you had recorded it, but it hadn't aired yet.
Right.
But it was the weirdest thing because I was sitting up in the balcony with my wife. And at the very end of the show, like after you gave the dramatic finish and everything, you had a well-intentioned heckler like give you notes immediately afterwards. And I couldn't hear what she was saying, but all I could tell was that it seemed like she thought that you should have used an alternate ending or something.
Oh yeah. Yeah. I remember that. And it's rare, but there are people who feel like they know better than me. I mean, just the act of heckling is so arrogant because you are essentially saying that you can do a better job than the person who's dedicated their life at it for years. And I mean, it's why I wouldn't say I stopped, but I listened to sports radio much less because I can't stand when people think they know better than head coaches or former players or anyone. They just don't know what goes into these things, and a lot of their suggestions are just foolish or crazy.
Yeah, that's a world I live in. But it's funny though. You'll be back. People always, they grow up and they mature out of sports radio, and then something's gonna happen. You're gonna be like 58 years old.
Yeah.
And you're gonna need something. You need something to latch onto. It'll be like Belichick's fourth replacement by then. I'll be coaching the Patriots and
right.
So I actually wanted to ask you that question and go into as much length as you want or not. But I heard you being interviewed on NPR about your college football career. And there was an article about it as well. And a couple articles have been written about it. But I've been fascinated by the story of the two coaches that took you in when you were in high school.
Yeah. Everyone brings that up, and I'm actually developing that story into a series with Adam McKay, who, I mean, he did Anchorman and The Big Short and Eastbound and Down. He's just a great guy. So he heard that, and he reached out, and we connected, and so we're working on a series about that. But there are two twin brothers that we mentioned in the interview on it's on This American Life with Ira Glass. And they were twins. I was 17 or 18. They were 28 years old. They lived together. They shared this two bedroom apartment in Salem, Mass. And they shared a Nissan 300ZX. And they were assistant coaches. But as you know, assistant coaches on a high school football team aren't usually even paid.
I have
no idea how they were making money to take me out to breakfast every day, and they they brought me to this gym and they trained me and they taught me routes, but they were also really eccentric. They were guys who at a time when only nerdy kids were reading comic books, were super into comic books, and they had played at Boston College and they were in terrific shape. They worked out all the time. They hated wearing t-shirts. So they were always without their shirts on, showing off their muscles and everything. But they were the first people that I ever met in person who talked about themselves in the third person.
Yeah.
So that they had dubbed themselves the Jetsons because they felt that they were out of this world. And but neither one was identified as anything but a Jetson.
Were they identical?
And okay. They both answered to Jetson. And they would call me and they called me Go Man, and they would say, Go Man, it is Jetson. You will meet the Jetsons at the Universe Gym in Salem at 7:30 a.m. and then we will take you for breakfast and discuss your future. And it was one of those things where their energy, their positivity, and their humor was so intoxicating. They were just really optimistic and made these huge promises. They were like, you'll get a football scholarship, there'll be newspaper articles written about you.
And you had never played football before?
No, only like to play catch or touch football. I'd never run a route that was determined or anything like that. I would just try to get open. I didn't know any of the plays. And
they had seen you as a basketball player, this kid that had potential in this frame. You're what, 6'5", 6'6"?
Yeah.
They could treat like clay.
Yeah. I was 6'5" and 220 pounds. And they were substitute teaching. I think that's how they made a lot of their money. They were substitute teaching one day in gym class. And they saw me playing basketball, and then one of them, there was one who was a little bit more reasonable and serious than the other, but not by much. And he said, if you beat me in a game of one-on-one, I won't bother you again about playing football. And I was obsessed with basketball, and he was just an athlete, and I beat him, and he broke his promise, and he called me on the first. He called me on the first day of summer vacation and told me that he was going to train me. And in 6 weeks, I put on like 15 or 20 pounds and changed really my life and my body and my trajectory. Cause I don't know what I was going to do after senior year, if it wasn't for them.
That's where, and I thought about this as I was listening to you and Whitney Cummings on, it was January 29th, 2020. I was listening to this. You guys didn't mention COVID once. Very insensitive.
No, no, I know. It was crazy. We had no idea.
It was strange as I'm listening. I'm like, wait, they're actually in person. That's when I checked the date.
Yeah.
Well, so you guys were talking about, I think she mentioned something about The Secret, you know, and then you brought up vision boards and how you're into vision boards and envisioning all this stuff. And that's when I made that connection with hearing that on This American Life. You were introduced like your senior year in high school to kind of this concept of putting something out there that seems ridiculous and unachievable. Yes. And Gary, that doesn't make any sense at all. Like you're going into your senior year, you never played football before. The scholarships have already been doled out. And yet you ended up with a scholarship to Boston College.
Yeah. I mean, and part of it is one of those things where unless somebody tells you something is impossible, you won't internalize that, and that's what happened there. The interesting thing was sort of the tension between these guys who would say F yeah to everything, and my family, which was a family of pessimistic Jewish people. Just and we have every right to be pessimistic. Things generally don't work out for my people, but my parents, when I would express excitement for something, they would say we'll see, or don't get your hopes up.
They got to protect you, Gary.
Yeah, and I also had to protect my dreams and aspirations from them. So I didn't really tell them I was even training with these guys or what they were promising me, because I knew I had sort of figured out the system. For instance, with this Adam McKay series that we're working on, I have not told my family about it, because they will, for instance, my mother will say, "Well, who's that?" And it'll just crush me, because she said, it's the same thing she said when I told her I was working with Judd Apatow on my special. She said, "I don't know who that is." And it just made me feel really, it humbled me, I would say. And also it just, she's very good at deflating me by asking, "What does that mean?" Or "Who is that?" And it's just, unless I mention somebody of the magnitude of a David Letterman or a Jay Leno, she really doesn't have much connection with my world.
Well, was she more excited about you being on NPR than some of the actual comedy things you've done?
She didn't know about This American Life or Ira Glass. I had to play it on my phone. It is not in me to explain to people the significance of things that I do. It just because as I'm saying it, I'm realizing that just the fact that she's not aware of this thing, it means that it hasn't really penetrated her world.
I felt like when I got excited, because I think I was just downloading This American Life at random, and your episode popped up, and I got excited for you, because I know that you have a side of you that feels like you want to be a college professor, or you kind of have this professorial vibe, and you help out the young comedians and all that. I feel like being on NPR in some ways was probably almost like being on HBO as well.
Yeah, it's interesting, because we were talking about dream vision boards or whatever earlier, and I had cut out a picture of an ad for This American Life from a magazine, and I had put it on this vision board in 2010, and I the whole thing is that these things usually come to pass, but they're sort of like that Twilight Zone make a wish type thing. Like, yeah. I was in People Magazine's Sexiest Man Alive, but it was to cover my debilitating depression and anxiety disorder. So it wasn't, I wasn't actually featured as a sexiest man alive. It was just an article in that issue.
That's way closer than most people ever get. And
it's true, but it's still this weird sort of thing where I think maybe I should have been more specific about my wish and
yeah, but then if you're too specific, then all of a sudden you start looking at progress like it's a setback too, right?
Oh, I know. That's so true. It's so true. I think that the idea is that you are reasonable in your expectations, but unreasonable in your work ethic, so that you put in more effort and preparation than you think is really healthy.
It's so hard to find, and especially for you and for my listeners that haven't seen Gary's special, The Great Depression. Gary is a comedian who is just incredibly talented and just works his butt off at making some of the most mundane, boring things in life really, really funny, like things like grapefruit and stuff like that. For years and years and years, you did that. And then all of a sudden, in The Great Depression, I won't give away too much for people who haven't seen it already, you really dive deep in this lifelong depression that has plagued you. And it's been a good couple of years, though, since that special came out, right?
Yeah, it came out, well, a year and 2 months ago. And yeah, in October, the beginning of October of 2019. And it was just this situation where I was really sick, too sick to perform. And then when I came back, it was so obvious that something was off that I had to address it. And the most comfortable way I can address anything is by making people laugh about it or joking about it. And so then my manager, who is the thinker in terms of commerce and viability in the business world, said, you should do this as a show. Like, we could make it part documentary and part comedy. And at the time I only had maybe 15 minutes of jokes about my depression and the treatment and being in the hospital. And so we were going to really mostly put documentary interviews and things with my psychiatrist and some of my friends and my wife. And then as I got better and felt better and had more energy, I was able to really tap into my experience. And with the director that I worked with, he really brought out of me a lot of great stories and things that we were able to play for comedy. And then it became something where the final product, the documentary footage, is about 15 minutes and the stand-up is an hour. And I mean, I don't want people to think that it's all jokes about being depressed. It's more jokes about what you do when you're depressed, and also the often hilarious ordeals of dealing with your treatment, like being in the hospital. Like as soon as I was in the hospital, I mean, I'm not exaggerating, within a half hour, man recognized me from TV. And he was like, am I crazy or are you Gary Goldman? And I just remember thinking, I may never do stand up again, but if I do, I have to tell this story because it's completely bizarre.
Yeah. I hadn't really thought of it from that perspective before, where you were so low at that point that you would question whether you'd ever do comedy again, which again, and you know, and honestly, your special, and then just some various things that I've read in the past year since I saw your special, I feel like I have a little bit better of an understanding of just how bad it is, you know, and at that point, you have the depression to begin with, which is biological and it's in you, but you're also, there had to have been a certain amount of stress about your future, right? That is compounding that. Like when you're sitting in an institution and you can't write jokes.
Right. That's really interesting. And it's a great point, but I will say that it's mostly the biological, and the my evidence for that is that there were times when I was in more dire financial straits. There was a time I was underwater on my house, and the Great Recession hit. I wasn't well known enough to get many gigs. The shows that I did were not full of people who were there specifically to see me. I was just a stand-up who had a moderate amount of success playing the road, and I was broke. I mean, I was really broke. I remember selling baseball cards to pay my mortgage and things like that. And yet I was happier than I was a few years later when I was in the midst of this depression, and I was in a much better position financially, and I had an audience, and I was able to make a good living on the road, and I had a nice apartment. But I think when you're feeling so lousy about yourself and lose your confidence, you think, well, I'm not going to be able to sustain this. And whereas I had hoped that I would get to a point where I was able to sell more tickets, the time when I was broke, I was convinced that I was going to stop being able to write jokes and stop being able to sell tickets, and I would lose everything. And it just spirals, and you do that catastrophic thinking that most people have sort of a release valve in their brain, but with a depression, it just keeps snowballing, and it's really problematic when it gets to a level where you can't really think for yourself, and you can't see any way out of it, and that's when it gets scary. When I would think that, I remember a friend of mine telling me that I was really, my life was in danger, and I had never heard it put so stark, but it was, looking back, it was definitely the case.
Well, and I heard you say in another one of your interviews that one thing that people with depression or a lot of issues in life, really, you don't really genuinely understand how off it is, or that these aren't the issues that other people are dealing with necessarily. I mean, there are other people with it, but it's not a normal thing to feel that way.
Yeah, that's a great point, because I think a lot of people don't understand that you can have everything and things that, and it still happens to me nowadays. Like I was listening to this biography of, I really love this young rapper named Kendrick Lamar. And I was listening to this biography of him, and he was talking about being depressed And even though I've been through all this, I thought, how would a mid-20s kid who was just killing it on the Grammys and the MTV and was a millionaire, how would he be depressed? And then I was like, what are you doing? You're falling into that same trap. It really has nothing to do with success. And I think it was really Bruce Springsteen's autobiography where he talked about not being able to get out of bed. And I thought, the thing that we always think as athletes and people who they're whether it's in athletics or other endeavors, we have a mindset where we put in work and we succeed and we feel good about our accomplishments. And when you're depressed, you think that you just need to keep applying that formula, but you realize at some point that no matter the success, you keep filling this bucket that has a hole. So it doesn't accumulate and you don't feel any better. And when you see somebody like Bruce Springsteen, he would say, well, nobody works harder. And I don't think there's anybody who's been as successful in his generation. And yet he doesn't feel great about himself. And people, I'm sure, would say, but you're Bruce Springsteen, and he still doesn't feel like getting out of bed. I mean, I think that really hit me. And I said, no, there's no amount of work or accomplishment I'll be able to do where I will feel good about myself. I need to feel good about myself first. And that's, and also accept who I am, sort of accept my limitation. And it's interesting that I did that This American Life in the same year that started my strongest recovery, sturdiest recovery. I mean, I'm going on 3 years of feeling myself. And that was a big step in telling a large audience, because I've told every comedian I've worked with who's asked me about my football career that it was an utter failure, but I had never told everyone who listens to NPR what a failure I was. And the people didn't come and insult me or drag me. They actually said it was a really interesting thing and something that I shouldn't be ashamed of. So I think that coupled with the right treatment, but also accepting myself, I think that was huge.
There's a woman who's a professor at University of Houston, and I know you've got a huge fan base in the University of Houston Law School, right?
that's right.
They were all there. Right. They filled up like a whole section at the White Oak that night. there's a professor there named Brené Brown who's got a bunch of best-selling books, but her whole thing is vulnerability, and it's really interesting.
Yeah.
I would advise, at the very least, looking at the TED Talk of Brené Brown, the most famous one. Yeah. She talks about vulnerability. You, by the way, I'm kind of pissed at you because you recommended, I asked you what was the favorite book that you had read recently, and you said The Nickel Boys. So I read The Nickel Boys last week, and Gary, I was cruising along, and I'm kind of doing all right. Yeah, so this is very good prose. It's a very good, very good story, and I was kind of thinking of some things I might want to ask Gary about. And then I got to the... I don't want to give anything away on this book, and I won't go into too much detail. I got to the last chapter. I broke down like bawling three separate
Me
times.
Too. And
you, yeah. Did it catch you off
Me
guard?
Too. Yes. Yes.
Yeah.
I mean, the whole thing is you fall in love with the protagonist and the boys at this reform school dormitory. And then at the end, I don't want to give anything away. I will just say it's as good a novel as I've ever read, and I am an avid reader, so it's really something else.
I genuinely, honestly want to thank you for recommending it. It was
good.
It was the first thing I thought, though, when all of a sudden, you know, sometimes when something catches you and you don't expect it to.
And
it wasn't even the initial part that changes in the plot. It was when all of a sudden there was some way he phrased it, because Colson Whitehead is just a brilliant writer. And it kicked me in the gut. Like I had a physiological jerking response, and I said, fucking Gary.
Oh man. I'm actually pleased by that, because I can't tell you how many people I've either given that book to or recommended it to, and they didn't read it.
Oh, really? Oh, okay.
Didn't finish it, but I have one close friend, my friend Sammy Koppelman, who is a writer and a brilliant young man, and he read it and we just we really bonded over that. So I'm so glad that you read it. That means a lot to me that you took my advice.
Oh no, I really, Gary, and I think I told this story when you're in studio with us last year. But when I was trying to figure out what I was going to do with my life after football, I was working for a friend of mine in Western Pennsylvania doing oil and gas stuff. And I was driving all over rural Pennsylvania, working on like contracts and deeds and oil rights. And it was interesting stuff, but I was listening to Sirius on the Comedy Channel there, and you kept coming up. So I searched you out on iTunes. And I think back then I still had to, like, I bought your albums. I bought two albums on iTunes. Yeah. But I remember just there was something about your way with words and how well crafted and just how good you were at your craft that just it made me realize I don't know what I'm doing with my life or what I want to do, but I need to do something different. And it's got to be something with words. And it was one of the things that kind of spurred me on to doing whatever the hell it is I'm doing now. And I'm really glad for it because this was the exact opposite of vision boarding. I was kind of just a piece of flotsam on a wave. and you were part of the wave that pushed me to where I am.
Oh, that makes me so happy because you're clearly suited for this and you clearly have what it takes, but mostly it's just that feeling that it's fine to be working with deeds and contracts, but if there's something that you would rather be doing and there's something that you would actually be bummed out if it got canceled or you weren't able to do it. I mean, that's the whole thing that I've noticed about my comedy career from the very beginning. It was something I always looked forward to doing. And then that sort of that athlete's competitive kick competition type thing kicks in where you want to do right by this thing that you really appreciate. And with us, it's our use of words and the sentences we make.
Do you still consider yourself an athlete?
Well, I don't consider myself an athlete as much because I still can't get past the fact that I didn't leave sports on my own terms. I sort of got overmatched. So I always think of myself as kind of I gave it a shot, but I do use on a daily basis the same types of attitudes and approaches that I used in sports. And the earlier you figure out that those types of behaviors translate to every single area of your life is really helpful. I know that I'm writing a book right now, and a few years ago, I think I would have given up after the first set of notes came back from the editor. Yeah. because it's very discouraging. And I just was able to look back on comedy and then before that on sports and say, well, this is how you felt when you first started playing basketball. You felt overwhelmed and you didn't really know even the fundamentals. And you loved it and you kept going and you improved. I mean, that's the one great lesson that you get from playing sports is that there's a direct correlation between effort and improvement. You may not master it, but you'll get better. And I was telling my wife this the other day out of nowhere. I said, the best thing about me is that I will be a better version of what you have now in 20 years. I will be a better husband, a better performer, and a better human being than I am
It's you know, it's amazing. It's like geological time when you think about your own lifespan, and it's like geological time where you can't necessarily grasp or envision how long an actual lifetime is, and you want to try to do everything. I want to fix this by next week in my personality. And that it really is amazing what can happen over the course of 20 years. And I'll have a book recommendation for you then. Speaking of that, hold on. I've got it right here. I just want to be sure I get the author's name right. Atomic Habits by James Clear.
Oh, I just finished that.
Did you?
Yes.
Isn't it great?
It's awesome.
Yes.
It's awesome. And it makes improvements in the first couple of pages.
Yes. Yes. Yeah. Gary, I'm very skeptical of most self-help books. More importantly, I'm skeptical of self-help book authors. This one, it's almost the thing that really frees you is that he's almost like an anti-motivation author. He's like, no, motivation will fail you. You need to engineer your life in such a way that you just do these things.
Yeah. I mean, just the the idea of approaching it from so many different angles and making choices that you can sort of live with and improve on. I mean, it's Atomic Habits is a must read within that area. The other one I would say for artists that I found in the same vein was this thing called the War of Art. It's about 120 pages, and it's really helpful if you have a creative project that you're working on.
It's tough love.
It really
gives you like a kick in the butt, right?
Yeah, but it's also one of these books where you halfway through you're like, I got to stop reading and get back to work.
Yeah.
So it does its job so quickly. Yeah.
That's really good. I think I listened to part of that on an audiobook. I'll have to pick that back up. The Atomic Habits book, I read that in September, and since then, because I've got my own set of issues. It's not depression, but it's other things. And I've realized how much exercise helps and how much of a difference it makes in stabilizing everything. And I've missed 2 days of exercise since September 1st.
Wow.
And one of them was because I had to go to the hospital, but I'm still kind of upset with myself. But the whole you put together streaks. If you miss your habit one day, the very next day, don't beat yourself up over it. Just do it. If you do something for 1 minute, you can check it off your box. Cause the most important thing is to just get in the habit of doing things.
Yeah. I found the idea of just setting a timer and saying, I'll just do it for this amount of money is it gets you over that inertia hurdle, which is the hardest part. Just opening up your laptop and starting your document or starting to return emails. That's the first one is the hardest. And these little tricks help you get through that.
The one other question I wanted to ask you was, since the special, I know for comedians, it's hard sometimes to hit the reset button and kind of start new and start working on your new stuff. This seems like it would be tenfold that type of problem, because you completely changed your whole, like almost your whole genre, where you went much more into your personal history. Has it been hard to maybe either, I don't know how to phrase it, remember who you are or define who you are, or has it been kind of liberating?
It's only been positive in a number of ways. And one was that before that special, I kind of recognized that I was going to need an adjustment in the content of my specials or my shows, my live shows, which eventually become my specials. So I wanted it to be able to speak about things that were a little bit more substantial than say sweet potato fries or state abbreviations. and I knew that I was going to be able to do it, but this was a way to do it in such a quick way where I think I'll be able to keep my fans who were with me before the special, I'll be able to keep them. And then the new ones that I met who will be expecting more of a personal or vulnerable show, they will be in tune with what I want to do next, which is not going to be as I guess I never thought it was dark, because I always felt like I was expressing a lot of hope, but I guess more, I'm not going to talk about such serious topics. Like, the thing I want to talk about next really is kind of my experience with financial insecurity from my childhood and then growing up and what it means to be poor. But the great thing about talking about being poor is that it is, it's that one area that almost everybody who goes to a comedy show can relate to, whether they were broke in college or after college or actually broke when they were children. I mean, it's something that people can relate to. And I also think it's something that I think people are recognizing the people who are doing really important things and are not being paid as well as us, for instance. Like, it's just I wish there was a system to tip the people who are working at the grocery store, because they kept us alive for so long, or even the people who are doing the nearly impossible work in hospitals. If there were some way to contribute, I mean, there are ways to contribute, but I always feel like it's they don't actually see your appreciation when you donate online or something like that. But I back to the question, I don't feel any kind of pressure to match that last effort, but the effort itself, I think, opened up some avenues to me that I might not have had. And I think that was a really fortunate situation. I mean, the other lucky thing was that I was able to write that show way before I needed to record it and film it. So after I filmed it, I had all these jokes to work out that had nothing to do with the Great Depression. And I was able to do those on the road before the Great Depression aired. So I had all that time to sort of build up a new set, so that after the Great Depression aired, I was able to go on the road and put out bring them a new hour and a half that they hadn't just seen on television for free, which is, that used to be my biggest fear, that I was not going to be able to bring the audience a new set. And because of there's no other explanation for it, but my health being so much better, and also the confidence I got from being able to finally take the football over the goal line as far as making my best special, I think that contributed to my being able to write at a pace that I've never come close to this before.
Oh, really? It just you kind of feel like everything had been, all the obstacles and barriers had been cleared.
Yeah. I mean, it's hard to go over your notes and prepare and write new things when you are trying to stay in bed until a half hour before the show and sprint over to the club and you're wrinkled, you haven't shaved, and maybe you've showered. So it's a big difference.
Yeah, that's a big difference in your day-to-day life. I'm glad you mentioned that about the essential workers too, because I share your same feelings for it. And I've got the extra guilt of having been labeled an essential worker as a sports talk radio host. I got this placard or this certificate in the early days when we were on a complete lockdown. And I'm like looking around like, my news is not all that important and I don't have to risk anything to deliver it. So I tried to use it very carefully. I suppose that You were also, as much as there are new challenges in being a comedian these days, and kind of some of the backlash you can get, it's probably somewhat liberating too, because it's easier than ever to find your specific audience, that it doesn't have to, it doesn't always have to be a mass appeal.
Yeah. I mean, that's something that I'm so grateful for, because I think back on my early days of stand-up, there's no way I could have been able to even know if the subjects and the stories I was telling in that special were funny or would work, because your average comedy audience is just there to see a comedy show. And if you deviate sort of from the what they're expecting, they're not always that it doesn't appeal to them. And so you don't get a good gauge on what works. But my audience that I had gathered over the years, and in some places it's a couple of hundred people, and in some cities it's a few thousand, but they come and they sort of have a similar idea of what's funny that I do, and they know what they're getting with me, so they give me some leeway. And they're I mean, it's like, just in the example of the NPR, the NPR audience is easier to get away with talking about things that are more serious than, say, a group of college kids or people going out for a bachelorette party on a Friday night in Tampa.
Gary, I really appreciate you coming on with me. What are we looking at? What should people be looking for here in the near future?
Well, I think that I'm about a year and a half away from putting this book out. It's called K-12. And it's a memoir of my experience as a public school kid. So it's all these funny stories and a lot of things that you look back on and you say that nobody will believe this happened, but they're true stories. And then hopefully my tour that was interrupted in March will come back when that's safe, and there are tentative dates on GaryGulman.com, but as we all know, they're all written in pencil at this point.
Yeah, that's and the New York City Comedy Club is it sounds like things are getting pretty dire.
Yeah, it's really distressing. Yeah, I worry about it.
And I guess there's no way for people who haven't made it right now, or who are maybe struggling comedians, I suppose, really, to really make money doing comedy, are there?
Yeah, it's hard. I don't know how they do it, but I reached out to a number of different comedians to see how they're holding up, and they haven't accepted my offers of money yet. So I think they're figuring out something either through Patreon or through their podcasts or whatever. So I think they're doing okay, but it would be a tough time if, say, you started doing comedy a year ago and now you're been put on the bench all this time
with no audience whatsoever. All right. I don't want to leave on that downer. I had this question occurred to me. I assume that when you get recognized in the street, like, people just throw out random bits or like,
chunks. Yeah.
What's the most common one?
I don't know what the most common one is, but the best one I ever got was, I live in Harlem, and at about 135th Street, which is really far uptown, a guy saw me and he yelled out, "Ne'er-do-well, ne'er-do-well," which is from my abbreviations joke. And I mean, I wanted to hug him. I'm still at a point, and I don't know where you are at this, but I'm still at a point where being recognized makes my day, and I'm really happy about that, because it doesn't happen that much.
Oh, it's the best. You know, I'm in the best possible world, because I'm not like I'm a B-level local celebrity, which means that for the most part, only people who genuinely listen to me or remember me from playing over a decade ago are the people who recognize me. It's not like my face is up on billboards or on the, you know, on television regularly. So anybody that sees me is probably kind of like you. It's somebody that's actually seen yeah. your work or done yeah. anything. And it's, so it's really, it's nice. It feels like, oh, okay. I'm just going to go ahead and use that as actual validation from somebody that's a stranger, but I'll pretend it's my dad or something.
Right. It's cool.
So, really appreciate it, man. Good luck. Oh. Good luck with a book. I'm really impressed, especially because it's a year and a half out, which is, that is a sustained effort. Good for you. Keep that up.
Yeah. It always reminds me of school when I would have a paper due and I would be, so stressed out. So I'm giving myself plenty of time.
I'm really excited for you because you are so good with words. And yet, you know, I don't want to do your jokes more poorly, obviously, than you do them, but your whole thing about the suicide note.
Oh yeah. Yeah. I was concerned about that joke because I didn't want to upset people because it's a serious topic, but I didn't want to commit suicide without leaving a note. And I hated writing essays. So that saved my life. My desire to avoid papers saved my life.
No, and it's, somebody's always going to think something goes too far, but look, like many people, I've got close people who've committed suicide. I think that's a feeling, that's a universal feeling that people have had about whether it's a suicide note or some other really, really important thing that they haven't done just because they labored too much over it instead of just doing it. Yeah.
It's interesting because we reached out to the National Federation for Suicide, Foundation for Suicide Prevention, and showed them the special, and we asked them about that specifically, and they said it was fine. So I kept it in, but I'm glad I did because it's a lot of people say that's very memorable.
Well, Gary, I really appreciate it, man. Good luck with all the projects, and everybody follow him on Twitter or Instagram. Gary Gulman on both of those, right?
At Gary Gulman, yes.
Gary,
yes.
Good job locking that down early.
Yeah. So. Yeah.
All right, cool.
Seth, it was great talking to you, brother.
My dad works in B2B marketing. He came by my school for career day and said he was a big ROAS man. Then he told everyone how much he loved calculating his return on ad spend. My friends still laugh at me to this day.
Not everyone gets B2B, but with LinkedIn, you'll be able to reach people who do. Get $100 credit on your next ad campaign. Go to linkedin.com/results to claim your credit. That's linkedin.com/results. Terms and conditions apply. LinkedIn, the place to be.
In life, some days are good, and some could be better. The same is true for recovery. Both take work. Both take adjustments. Finding your path is a key part of your journey. And then it's all about walking it every day. Embrace the good days, the not-so-good days, and the challenges, and acknowledge how you overcame them. Be open to every part of the journey and welcome it. It's unique, and it's all part of you. Find the path to recovery that works for you. Learn more at cdc.gov/stopoverdose.
Trying to figure out what to eat for dinner yet again? With Norsides and bouillon as your not-so-secret ingredient, you can skip the drive-thru and do dinner at home. Nor Taste Combos provide a menu of delicious, affordable, and well-balanced meals that you can prepare in 30 minutes or less. Visit nor.com to get quick and easy recipe ideas for your home-cooked weeknight dinners. It's not fast food, but it's so good.
Oh, 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 O'Reilly!
Protect your vehicle's engine with a full synthetic oil change and save with Mobil 1 at O'Reilly Auto Parts. Purchase 5 quarts of Mobil 1 full synthetic motor oil and receive a $10 O'Reilly gift card after rebate. See store for details. With your Mobil 1 purchase, you'll also receive 2x points during Old Rewards Bonus Points Month at O'Reilly Auto Parts.
Oh, 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 O'Reilly Auto Parts.
If you want the real story behind the NFL, you need the Stinkin' Truth Podcast. 3-time Super Bowl champ Mark Schlereth breaks down the biggest plays, the biggest games, and the untold stories that make this game what it is. Follow the Stinkin' Truth in the Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts.